It's time for Intersections, where art and science meet, your weekly hour of conversation, where you learn about curious ideas, creative works, and interesting phenomena with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Now, it's time for Intersections, where art and science meet.
I'm Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, where we create a museum without walls so artists, scientists, and the community can create unique interactions and conversations. And in today's conversation, we're going to be talking with Sis Height, who is Professor Emerita in Art History at the University of New Hampshire, and Len Sussman, who earned an AB from Harvard and an M in Architecture from Yale. And then you practice commercial and residential architecture in New England for more than 40 years. Our conversation is going to be about museum architecture and what is its role, not only in the preservation of objects, but also can the museum be a work of art itself? And welcome, Sis and Len.
Hello.
Hello.
Thanks for having us.
It's great to have you both. So it really makes some sense to begin, I think, our conversation with what the most important question is, which would be the idea of what is a museum, right? So I think a lot of people get confused about that because we have children's museums now, we have that don't have a collection. We have science museums that may or may not have a collection. So it, I think it was clearer at one time, but now it's got kind of, we call lots of things museums. So who wants to tackle that?
I can give that a try. I agree with you, Mark. It was once very clear what a museum was. Expectations were, I suppose, you could say they were for a rather austere, imposing building, civic building, borrowing authority and authenticity from familiar images of Greek and Roman temples or posh private residences or palaces. And now the whole game has changed. We're expecting to be surprised and delighted by images that we have never seen before. And there is great risk for architects, for museum curators, benefactors of museums in the results of those experiments. So things have changed.
And Sis?
Yeah, things have changed a lot. I mean, in the beginning, well, let's go back maybe as far as the Renaissance or something like that. There were private collections. They were for elites, for enjoyment, for edification. And gradually this changed in the 20th century, which we'll get to. But originally, museums were to, I mean, essentially contain, preserve, and present a collection. But the collection was usually presented to either the owner's buddies, you know, who were very wealthy. But it was essentially a kind of elitist institution. And as Lynn said, it started out as being a kind of temple-like place where you went and bowed down before the works of art. But it's quite different now. I mean, there are all kinds of things. It's a social space. There's more of an emphasis now on education. And I'm sure we'll get into all these things, welcoming and responding to diverse audiences and things like that. And so this is our concern now. What about the collection? We don't want the collections, whether they be science or art collections, to be completely ignored now, because it's been, you know, especially since COVID and after, a different kind of place.
Right. And museums were already beginning some of that transition. As I said, you know, children's museums, I was a part of that early movement myself. But science museums, where the collection just wasn't there, they didn't collect. However, I did work for a children's museum that had a collection, and it was important. But you're right, it was there. But I think it's interesting, Len, you mentioned the idea of the building being, after some of these, really what would be off-putting for a lot of people in the public. So they were designed after royal palaces or things that just people in the common everyday wouldn't have had experience with.
I agree. I think that there were many people who, in the classical period of classical museums, would feel a bit overawed, would feel as though they needed to have taken some prerequisite courses before earning the right to enter a museum.
Right. And they made, from the beginning, that's how they've also, when you were talking about social, inside many guards, because we did have valuable things, and sometimes the guards felt more obtrusive and you felt like you were on the in-group or not the in-group. If you'd never been to a museum before ever, let's think of some of our communities that really have never seen a museum or have been invited in. That becomes really an interesting experience to go into some place that feels very, very protected.
Well, that's where museum architecture really comes in. Instead of the temple-like place that looks like it's for somebody else, the idea that it's a more, starting with the exterior, that it's a more inviting, welcoming kind of place and that people aren't afraid to go in there. I just wanted to mention one thing. You mentioned children's museums and science museums. They, for a long time, going back to Frank Oppenheimer or whatever, have done something art museums did not do, and that is have hands-on exhibitions, which they're doing now. Finally, art museums are, you know, saying, hey, this is something we have to do to really engage people. And that's the way some people are engaged, not just children, but adults as well. Yeah.
Right. I think that's a really good point. And that would mean the interior architecture would also change, because that's for, you were thinking about galleries that had walls and lighting. Now you're talking about interactives. That's a whole different ballgame in terms of design.
And you want the interior to be welcoming too. You know, Where am I? Where do I go? I don't want to be confused. It's too confusing. And this way looks interesting and exciting. I think I'll go in this direction, you know, whatever, rather than having it all wayfaring is something that Lynn has talked about, you know, instead of having your way mapped out precisely, to have it be more open and have people say, well, I'm interested in going in that direction, or look at that way, you know, and moving in different parts. But it's all more welcoming, I think, or that's what people are trying to achieve.
Yeah, there's definitely more freedom for the visitor in terms of choice. But as one who's been behind the scenes, not necessarily in museum design, but in the design of buildings, be assured that architects are still just as concerned with creating either those paths of freedom or creating a more constricted path, more directed path. So there's intentionality. This is what I mean to say. There's intentionality in the apparent liberality in granting various paths, diversity of paths to visitors.
Yeah, and that's really interesting to watch that play out. And since you were talking about that in terms of education, what we want people to learn first and second still is a part of how some people think, but we have to realize that the visitor may just go on their own. You know, so we build these wonderful pathways, but they may just bypass a lot of what's in there. So that freedom of choice and how do you get both is really an interesting model, don't you think?
Oh, yeah. And I just heard a webinar a couple of days ago with Temple Grandin, who talked about people who see the world visually and they could only see things visually. And she's one of those people. But it's, you know, she is really pointing out the different ways people interact with their environments or absorb information, and that you can't just gear it toward one type of person, you know, with long wall panels or whatever. And, you know, so it has to be a variety of flexibility is what is really needed to, as there's more understanding about how people, children and adults learn things today.
Yeah. Len, in your experience, as museums have done, some of the older ones, as they've tried to adapt and change, what have you seen them try to do to make something that was more austere into something more inviting?
Well, I think we have to talk separately about existing museums and new museums. Existing museums develop collections of staggering proportions and typically have to keep most of their collection offsite in very humble storage or in attics or in basements and so forth. And the attitude of most contemporary architects when adding to existing structures is to differentiate that structure from the existing building. In a way, that's an attempt to honor the memory and, in effect, to preserve the memory, to respect the original designers, the original intent, and so forth. And also to they will use the contemporary qualities of the new addition to appeal to a wider wider audience, to interest a wider audience.
Yeah, so sometimes you do see an intentionality then of trying to attach something that looks fundamentally different than the other. A lot of chrome and glass might be attached to something that was more Gothic.
But this can be a problem too. I mean, I really feel that the new wing or the addition should, it could be modern and look different, but it should be in dialogue with the older building. And there aren't that many of these new museums that do that. And some are so extreme, like the, what's it called, the Royal Museum of Art in Toronto, which is an early 19th century building. And then this hideous, you know, it's like a big crystal sticking out from it, like a rocket ship. And, you know, I just find, as opposed to Venturi's Sainsbury wing at the National Gallery, where, you know, he's playing with the classical vocabulary of the original building. So, you know, it's a tricky situation to not be completely different, to somehow make it interesting, an interesting dialogue between the two, the older building and the new addition, but to make it exciting and interesting, which is what everybody's trying for.
But I would say that somebody loved that crystal at some time in Toronto. The building committee must have been convinced, persuaded somehow, with winning words by the architect, or some kind of notion that pushing the envelope and bursting through the design envelope was of value and bode well for boosting future attendance.
And, so what's your opinion of it?
Well, I would not, with the benefit of some time, some years having passed since the creation of that museum, I would say, no, not for me. I would enter it for the collection, but not to be thrilled by the by its appearance on the street. But that's what I meant when I used the word risk before. When you don't have strong traditions, design traditions behind you, powering your design, informing your design, you're taking a great risk, perhaps not with your building committee, which presumably supports you and is willing to spend millions of dollars to support, say, for instance, a crystal or a flying bridge or something like that, that it's going to work for the public, not only for the public on opening day, but the public 10 years, 20 years, and for a generation and generations to come. And I think there have been some extraordinary successes in recent years. The work of Renzo Piano, I think not all agree, but so far his track record is pretty good. I'm not sure I'm going to go on record as saying it's going to last forever, but what lasts forever?
How much does the, for both of you, how much does the training that an architect does and a designer, the type of training they have, contribute to what they design?
Well, that calls into question the whole notion of what training or architectural training is all about. And I think the jury is still out on that. It's a learn by doing. That's my impression from having attended one graduate school of architecture. But it's something you just have to practice over and over again. And the art and science of architecture are skills that are very difficult to acquire. And of course, it's not simply designing buildings, but it's marketing your services, dealing with the properties of materials, both short-term and long-term, and so on and so forth. It takes years to really master the art, Some folks are extraordinarily gifted and acquire those skills in a very short period of time. Typically, architects need to mature until they can interest the curators and the museum directors commissioning their services.
Didn't somebody like Renzo Piano, who you mentioned, every time another museum says they're doing a renovation by Renzo Piano, I think, he's the man of the moment, but, use some imagination, look at some other people who have different ideas. And you would know more about this, Lynn, having gone to architecture school, but don't you think the architectural education has evolved somewhat so that there's more interest in sociology, psychology, and things like that, how people respond to spaces and buildings, maybe than there was 25, 30 years ago. So I kind of have the impression that architecture studio classes, where it's supposed to be like working in an architecture firm and people are working, collaborating with each other, that these different elements maybe are brought together and looked at in a different way than they were originally, not to mention more specialization. I mean, there's some, yeah, like Renzo Piano does other kinds of buildings too, but one museum after another. So, he's aware of what a lot of the issues are and how to talk to directors, et cetera.
Right. I there's no doubt that architectural education has evolved since those many years ago when I was in school. To the extent to which those lessons that are taught in schools of architecture are made manifest in building remains to be seen. I think there's a time lag between education, partly because it takes so long to be recognized as a competent museum designer.
And Len, I think that parallels the development of exhibit designers also. It takes a while to be accomplished to understand, all the nuances that you have to design for a visitor. And you don't there isn't really a school for that. I mean, you go to it, but it's really years of practice in it and getting used to it. Do you think that some architects suffer from their own egos getting in the way when you talk about being designed for utility or for helping the visitor? Are there architects to have an ego problem?
Well, let me just say that you need a very sturdy ego, perhaps a little bit on the extra large size, double X, okay, extra large size, in order to engage in the art and science of architecture. But there's a point at which, unless it's stoked by those who commission architecture, you'll be slapped down sooner or later. Your fashionability will go out of fashion. This immediately makes me think of Frank Gehry, who's an extraordinarily talented architect, but who was hired again and again and again to do signature Frank Gehry buildings. Contrast him with someone like, and I'm going beyond museum architecture, Cesar Pelli, now deceased, extraordinary architect, who was simply known, and rightfully so, for the elegance of his design. He would not repeat himself from project to project. I think Renzo Piano, to give him credit, does differ. I mean, he does seek solutions that seem to be appropriate to the program assigned to him. So I've seen so many wonderful Frank Gehry buildings, museums in particular. I think I've seen enough for a while, and I'd like to see either Mr. Gehry, even at his advanced age, evolve in museum design, or others to step into his shoes.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting comment. You have to have that healthy ego, which is really what an artist has to have. When you design something, you have to step out there and have enough you know, I guess chutzpah to be able to be willing to do it. On the other hand, what you're saying is you also have to be willing to evolve your thoughts, your design, and move beyond, even though the public, I want that. You know, what happens, I think, is we see one in one place and board of directors and people making the decision, I want that, or a donor. And so we end up with that being the thing that's the signature rather than being a new design.
Right. And the architects I admire are the ones who come up with new solutions, new building types and everything, because each situation is different. And Rinso Piano, they're, you know, it's modernism, essentially. It's modernism from the 20s and 30s. And sometimes it doesn't really even fit with the museum that is being renovated, like the Harvard Art Museums, for instance, with this old building and beautiful stone and columns, and then a narrow little stairway, because he doesn't care about stairways, a narrow little stairway that has metal tubular railing and everything. Now, that doesn't fit with that kind of building. But no, you know, you go to one building after another, and that is of Rinso Pianos, and you see the same kind of thing, the extension to the Frick and in New York, or at the Gardner Museum in Boston, all kinds of places. But I really admire the ones who come up with different, you know, they're intellectually interested in the problems, in the kind of location, how it fits in with the buildings around it. Plus, as we were talking about earlier, how to make it interesting and inviting. So from the get-go, people go, hey, look at this place. I want to go in there.
Yeah, I think of two spectacular examples. One is the Museum of Man in Ottawa, where it's earthworks, it's domes. And in other words, the architects, that was a new museum, but they were able to design it to look, hint at what might be in there, right?
So yeah,
very different. And the other one that I think about when you were just speaking, Sis, is the Science North, which is in Ontario. And it's part of it is in the nickel mine, which they built the museum down in there. But the part that's out, which is the entry in some of the exhibit halls, is a snowflake from the top. And because they get so much snow where that is in Upper Ontario. So I think we have some examples of where somebody stepped out, except I don't know that I remember who the architect is, which is interesting. So maybe sometimes the design eclipses who their name is because they're designing differently.
Well, and people want boards, you know, of wealthy, you know, wealthy boards. They want a big name. They think a big name is going to, you know, bring in the money, et cetera, et cetera. And there is another kind of risk taking. Hey, let's find somebody who will do something maybe different and creative, et cetera. Yeah, there are a lot of interesting museums in Canada, British Columbia, museums of Native, Indigenous art. And
right.
Maybe there weren't as many to begin with. And so they're more comfortable not following precedent or something maybe. Like that. They're free.
I agree. One of the other things, Lynn, you keep mentioning the art and science of architecture, and I love that. Obviously, that's what we're about on the show. But I love this idea of how you have to not only think about how it looks and functions, but you also have to think about whether it can be built. And you have to think about the materials that you're going to use, the surfaces. Is somebody going to fall, you know, on something that you make that's too shiny or slick? Or you have all these things, including egress, and fire, or you have to have how many bathrooms? I mean, as mundane as that. So how do you wrestle the balance between science and art in this?
It would be so easy without that. Then it would be pure art, wouldn't it? Art for art's sake. But yes, it's a real world science. And you have to keep the rain out. You have to keep the environment constant inside. You have to be safe. Fortunately, there's a long tradition behind you, not only an artistic tradition, the design tradition, but there have been mistakes made in the past, and they've been corrected, some at great, great cost, windows falling out from Hancock Center and so forth. Mm-hmm. And we can rely on that past experience and the very responsible work of building code designers all around the country and around the world to inform today's architect as to how to, what pitfalls to avoid. And by the way, there's one factor, additional factor we need to keep in mind is that architects need to work within budget or be so phenomenally persuasive that the budget can be busted many times over, as it was famously with the Sydney Opera House, which went, I can't tell you how many times over budget, and which was designed without a real firm notion about how it should be engineered when it won its competition.
Yeah, and in today's world of the economics of museums, you are talking, you know, that's hard to run it over. You know, do I have another donor online, or will that donor up for that? And that's, you're right. I mean, I think it becomes even more important in the present day.
I remember back when I was in my 20s, I had a friend who was going to architecture school at Harvard, and we were in Dulles Airport outside of Washington, D.C. And so it has those, you know, soaring roofs and all the glass. And I said, oh, how did architects do that? You know, how did they figure that out? And he said, I don't know. I don't really know. I hated structures. So he hated taking structures in architecture school. But anyhow, once again, this is the kind of collaboration that's necessary. But there are all kinds of new things now, computers and using, like Frank Gehry uses aeronautical engineering software. So he could hand a scribble over to his computer people and say, you know, come up with how this is going to be built. So there's much more flexibility today in the 21st century in doing all kinds of different designs rather than having, you know, load-bearing walls and roofs and things like that, which makes it interesting. But one thing, for instance, there's the Milwaukee Art Museum. So I'm by Santiago Calatrava. And I made the a kind of a pilgrimage to go see it. And I drove there and I went with my daughter. We could see it from the distance. It just looks so beautiful. You know, even driving in the parking garage was beautiful. It was so spectacular and such an experience. I felt like I was a different person after I was there. And then later I talked to architects about it and architects who work at museums, and they just went, ah. You know, so it was this wonderful sculptural work of art, but as museum architects, they said this did not work. It didn't do what it should have done. Although it did certainly put the museum on the map. So it's, you know, how to balance being a sculpture, a work of art that brings people to see it on the so-called pilgrimage, and really functioning well as an art museum.
Those are real challenges.
Tricky challenges.
Very. I've been talking with Sis Height and Lynn Sussman about the whole idea of the art and science of museums, how you have to think about the museum, both from the outside and the inside. And we'll be right back.
Join us for the University of Indianapolis Faculty Artists Series on Saturday afternoons at 2:00. Host Michael Toulouse brings you his fine commentary as we showcase faculty and visiting artists performing exceptional concerts and recitals from the Crystal DeHaan Fine Arts Center on the University of Indianapolis campus. That's the University of Indianapolis Faculty Artist Series, Saturdays at 2 p.m. on 88.7 WICR.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Kiesling, and today I'm having a conversation with art historian Sis Height and architect Lynn Sussman. And when we went to the break, we'd been talking about a little bit about this inside-outside idea. In fact, we started with a little bit of that, how the architecture of a museum in and of itself is represented to the outside. Yes, we want to attract people. And then there's the inside where we have to have it function for what you're there to see, either for the objects or for the interactives that you're going to put into it. So why don't we start out with why do those do architects do things that they may on the outside just are fanciful? They don't match what's inside, but they don't necessarily detract. So there is this whole art form of the architect that's important.
Well, I immediately think of the Broad Museum in Los Angeles, which here we are without pictures
in the radio.
So
it's painful.
For those who've been to LA, you've been to the Disney Concert Hall. Just around the corner is the Broad Museum. It looks like an enormous gift box, but an extraordinary gift box. When you walk inside, it is just as sculptural, but you feel as though you're walking inside a scale model of the inside of the human intestinal tract. I mean, it's very,
oh my goodness.
It's very, very organic. Perhaps intestinal tract is not appropriate, but the architects delivered there. They delivered a certain kind of experience, both outside and inside, an attention grabber for sure on the outside, and something of a surprise which continues through the museums. But you know, when you get inside the principal galleries, it calms down. And you know, if you're going to hang paintings, you have to have a flat surface. You have to have good lighting, and it becomes, I won't say banal, but the background, the frame around the contents of the museum begins to take a background position relative to the collection. And I think that's appropriate. And even in Gehry's museums, eventually Frank has to yield to the orthogonal requirements of hanging pictures, you know, vertical walls and so on and so forth.
Yeah, hanging on curved walls is difficult.
Very, very difficult, unless you're doing curved art, of course.
Right. But that seems interesting. One of the things that it occurs to me when we're talking about that is you mentioned on that science side, you mentioned that whole idea that exterior, the way it functions, the way it works, we have to control light. We have to, you know, you can't really, in other buildings, you don't want to leak, but in a museum, you really can't have a leak because of the objects you have in there. You have to be able to control environment and humidity and all those things. And those are maybe, if not essential, but even more essential sometimes, because you can't damage the actual collection by your building design.
But you know what I think is another problem? Yeah, it's a very difficult kind of problem in terms of all of those things. But another problem, which is really kind of sad, is that sometimes an architect designs the outside and then they hire not just somebody to figure out an exhibit designer to figure out how to, you know, hang a particular collection, but the interior is designed by a different company, which is, you know, really an absolute shame. And to get back to the Sainsbury wing at the National Gallery in London, you know, it's playing with classical stuff on the outside, but Venturi was able to design the galleries and how things were hung in the interior. And so, and it fits the outside and the inside in that case fits together. But yeah, I mean, that could be another added difficulty and why people think they want to do it that way, hire exhibition designers to do the interior. You know, I don't know why that happens, but sometimes there's just no connection between the exterior and the interior of the building.
Well, sometimes there can be a phenomenal collaboration. You know, they create great harmonies together, as some musicians do. Sometimes the conflicts arise, and one of them, and it's usually the interior designer, has to be shown the door. But you need those two designers need to be able to work together. Now there are architects who, because of the strength of their reputations, can demand that they be permitted to design everything down to the doorknobs. You know, Frank Lloyd Wright was famously obsessive that way.
Down to the furniture and everything.
Furniture,
yeah, it was uncomfortable furniture.
Yeah, and the lighting and, you know, I mean, everything. And even overhang, I mean, your overhead space. Yeah. He intentionally didn't want you pausing in certain places.
But lighting art, you know, two-dimensional art or objects or sculpture and so forth has become quite a specialty these days. And even architects with very strong and sensitive approaches to lighting, you will never see them work without a lighting designer on a major project. Just too many bolts and widgets involved and lumens and so on and so forth.
So when I look, Sis, at a building and I look at its exterior, inside, a lot of times I can't let all that light transmit in, you know, but from the outside, it looks funny if I don't have windows or I don't have glass. And so this leads me to that idea of what do architects add to the outside sometimes that are just there because it needs to be there as a piece, a work of art?
In terms of light and windows?
Or anything, windows, or even sculptures or sculptural elements on what do they add sometimes that is part of the artwork?
Well, you know, I think new museums and new wings of buildings, they tend to have big glass, attachments to the original building. And so in that sense, with the new ones, they have light going in and out. And usually it doesn't matter as much about the control of light in the inside because those new wings are often not for works of art or, you know, precious collections of birds or what have you. And they are for, you know, restaurants and bookstores and all kinds of other things. So that's one thing that can happen. Because then you could control it and not worry about that. But then sometimes it would end up that the galleries themselves are just boxes and very uninteresting, you know, which is not a good thing either. But yeah, the bringing together that, you know, the landscaping, the sidewalk that goes up to the building, what the entrance looks like. If you, as you say, if you could see inside from the entrance, you know, that could, you know, bring people in as well. And often, as you mentioned, sculpture, having sculptures, working very closely with landscape architects to and also making it fit in somewhat with the neighborhood or not. It's not always done. You know, sometimes people don't even think about the exterior when they're thinking about museums. But it's really an important part of bringing people in. And, you know, the artistic process starts out there. The appeal to people, you know, does it make sense? Does it appealing? Does it give the museum an identity, which is what they're often looking for as well, directors and museum boards.
I love that idea because it starts, let's imagine I'm in a major city. It starts when I hop out of my taxi or I get off the bus, right? The education experience about what I'm going to do, why I would want to go in there starts way out there. From the facade of the building with banners and columns or however they're doing it, also the sidewalk and the way traffic flows and moves in and out.
And it works retrospectively too. I mean, I cannot think, I grew up in New York City, not far from the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and I cannot recall any experiences with paintings, my favorite paintings, without first imagining the facade of that building. Or mounting the steps of that building. So it's just a colossal aide memoir and it helps me retain personally. I think it helps people in general retain the memory of the collection, whether it be art or industrial stuff or scientific stuff, the location and the appearance of the building from the outside. Just as I will always remember your face, Mark, now that I see it on screen, in association with this wonderful conversation that you're moderating.
Thanks.
Well, that's because you're a visual thinker.
Well, yeah, that helps.
Who can also write?
Right. I think, you
you're
know,
a mixture.
Right. I think what's really interesting to me, too, is I was thinking about, I spent time, working for the Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago. And that building was built for the Columbian Exhibition, and it first housed the art museum. And then when the art museum moved, it took the lions with it that are up front. And that was because they were kind of signature to the front. And then its next occupant was the Field Museum, and they took the ladies that are out in front of the Field Museum. So it's really interesting. You're exactly right, Len, how much the identity might be with a certain feature, and you can retain that.
But that begs the question, of course, what's the relationship of the facade to the collection? So if you have a collection of fabulous Renaissance collection in a Broad Museum box, does that kind of disconnect affect your ability to retain the information that you've gained inside, or does it prevent connection from being retained?
I think that's a fundamental question. You know, I think about there's been some really innovative exhibit designers too. I think that when Mike Spock went to the, the son of Dr. Spock went to as the person in charge of design for the Field Museum, it was kind of really shocking. You know, he had a very modern kind of exhibit on shoes right when you went in the door. And it really was almost overwhelmingly a problem. I think he thought it would be great, set it aside, but you coming through this doorway. And so do you have to be, I guess what you guys are saying is you do have to be aware of the transitions you make.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah, I think architects are definitely sensitive to that. I think in Europe, the public is more accustomed to the flexible use of classical buildings that a succession of owners have not thought fit to demolish to make way for more modern appearing buildings. So they really love their patrimony, they respect their patrimony, and they're bound to determine to preserve their patrimony there. And to walk into a 19th century sense, a very posh, elegant building, and to see a modern exhibit, it's kind of exciting.
Yeah, so you do, that there is a reason to kind of hit you with that.
Right, it helps in the preservation of classical buildings. Because it renews their lease on the public interest.
Yeah, it honors them, really, rather than just tear it down.
Right, and then redefines them, right? You expect one thing, but it's like you said, after I've experienced it inside, then I can't forget the outside.
Right.
And the outside may not be as important after that. What I mean is not as important to orienting you as it is to then remembering.
Exactly.
That's something that's interesting in the direction that a lot of museums are going in, and that is they want to have a really dramatic building that will attract attention. So it's got to be really dramatic, and then there's the issue: does it really work with the collection, etc. But there's something else that's so big now on the forefront of planning, and that is studies show that millennials and Generation Z, etc., they want an experience. You know, they're not interested in the contents or education. They want an experience. So there's such an emphasis now in new buildings and additions that, it's got to be really, crazy wild maybe. And inside, they're just, okay, have auditorium where you could have immersive art shows and light shows and have, a place where you could have dancing and, a really fun restaurant. And so, you're going, hey, but what about the collections? What else can, it's almost like it's for entertainment and emphasizing experience rather than what the museum contains, how it could be rethought, how it could be added to, or what kind of temporary exhibitions can be brought in. It's really interesting, I think. sociologically.
I agree. Just a reminder, the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversations that explore the intersections between art and science. And we encourage you, along with your family, especially as we're coming up to the holidays, to have conversations with one another about some of the topics that we're talking about today and what your fondest memories of museum are. And we'll be right back.
Hi, this is Tony Morris. Join me for an hour of some of the best music for guitar on Classical Guitar Alive. Each week we explore a wide variety of music with guitar, and you'll also hear interviews with many of the world's foremost performers and composers. That's each week on Classical Guitar Alive.
Saturday mornings at 5 on WICR The Diamond.
Welcome back. I'm having a conversation with Sis Height and Lynn Sussman about what we can learn from the study of museum architecture and how it might change our overall museum experience. And, you know, what occurs to me, we're talking, how can we not have a conversation that occurs about post-COVID? And what I'm really curious about that idea is that it's not just COVID, but it's other things, fires, a flood event, a war. They change and can the nature of the architecture or the building. What happens when you're faced with that you have no building or you have to start over?
Well, I would say if you've lost your collection, collect first and build later. Collect first, establish that convention, that collection in a modest, rented, abandoned building, perhaps. Let it build its reputation slowly and surely, and then start looking for donors to put a suitable frame around that that collection, that fine collection. I would not build first, as Sis, I think you helped direct my attention to a Chinese museum that is an extraordinary structure, but has no collection. That has been done and continues to be done in wealthy countries. The collection comes first. That may be heresy to an architect's ears, but I'd say the contents come before the container.
Yeah. And this is something that museums are really wrestling with today, especially museums that started 150 years ago, universal museums that have collections from all over the world. And that is colonialism. How did they get those objects? And different countries in Africa, you know, Greece, you know, all kinds of different countries, are Native Americans are trying to get their objects back that were either stolen, grave robberies, or all kinds of things. And so, you know, how do they rethink their collections? And so part of that is the interior. How do they reinstall them? But also, I mean, in terms of the issue of colonialism, there is that interesting but very awful case of the National Museum of Brazil in Rio that had a huge fire about, I think it was about 5 years ago. And there were no smoke detectors. There were no, you know, water to come down when it started when it was on fire. There was no water in the water hydrants outside. They had to pump it in, et cetera. So anyhow, the building burned, a classical universal museum type building, and so did their collections. And among other things, there were collections from, I forget the number, it was something like 135 different indigenous groups in South America. So now the person who was the curator has been going out and meeting with these different groups saying, we have nothing now, we want to rebuild our collection. Do you have things we could have? And how would you like it to be shown? So they're really starting from the point of responding to Indigenous people and how they would like their collections to be. It's a whole different thing from just gathering all this stuff in the 19th century and putting it on display completely out of context. I think it's very interesting. COVID itself, there's things about working on how people move through museums so they don't bunch up together, spacing things that are on exhibitions so that people don't bunch up there. But there are all the other issues that started at the same time, that have really picked up at the same time, such as Black Lives Matter. How do you integrate more Black art, or Me Too, more art by women, or say, if, in the case of art museums, but also something like climate change. How can the architecture museum respond to issues in climate change? So there are a lot of exciting new changes and interests that museums are trying to respond to now.
I think that's really, that all those are so fascinating, and they really do explore, that's as much both general science and social science as to what's happening in there. And in a way, other than the colonialism, which was a problem, but when I think of some of the starts of museums, they were much like that. They kind of went out into the community. I think of a lot of community kinds of museums, that weren't already colonially, founded by somebody who was a collector, but places that they started collecting, they collected from local people. Those were the first collections. And then they maybe were in a house, and then they moved to a little bit larger building that they rented. And eventually they built what you were saying, Len, they built a building to house their collection. But they had already defined who they were.
Well, they did that with the National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington too.
Oh, you're right.
Where they went out and collected things,
people wanted to have in there.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. What a different model. And that's an opportunity. I was thinking COVID gave us the opportunity to pivot and do some things that were not inside the walls of the museum. That a concept of how do I reach the community? Maybe I can't fundamentally change all of my art pieces right away, but how do I, through my programming and my outreach, how do I change that? And those pivots that museums made, some of those will be eternally successful. They will change the museum.
Right. Absolutely. Rethinking and pivoting. I think that's really important.
Len, I know that there are some incredible new materials coming online that will help us with designing buildings to be more effective with climate change, from glass that can alter itself mm-hmm. to concrete and wood that does something different. And we're rethinking about these use of materials in new ways. How are they going to affect the future of museums?
Well, architects, way that architectural training has changed in the last generation is there's a much greater sensitivity to help architects be more environmentally sensitive to energy needs and so forth. There is, though, we have a relationship as human beings with some essential materials like wood and stone. Glass is an industrial material, granted, but it's been with us for a long, long time. And I find it personally comforting to be able to see that those materials used over and over again and in sometimes very inventive ways in buildings. We're all kind of grounded in those materials. But an occasional building that looks like French pastry and is made out of exotic resins, that's fine. But I hope it doesn't become the standard.
Right.
We're capable of finding other ways to insulate buildings to keep the rain out.
Wow. I want to thank both of you, Sis Height and Len Sussman, for our conversation about the art and science of museums. This has been really wonderful for me. I think our listeners will have a really great time thinking about, talking about, and having a conversation about. Until next time, I'm Mark Kiesling, reminding you to tune in again when we explore more curiosities from the intersection of art and science.
You've been listening to Intersections, where art and science meet, with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Just a reminder, the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversation that explore the intersections between art and science. We encourage you to explore further in conversation with others. Any of the ideas explored in today's show at www.thedaVinciPursuit.com.